Today, we have an interview with Matthew Ike of U.S. Energy. This is Jerry Tuma Smart Money, a broadcast of Cornerstone Financial Services with Cornerstone President and Founder, Jerry Tuma. Jerry Tuma is a certified financial planner. Securities and advisory services offered through Independent Financial Group, LLC, a registered investment advisor, member, FINRA, and SIPC. Cornerstone Financial Services and Independent Financial Group, LLC, are unaffiliated entities. Views and opinions heard on Jerry Tuma Smart Money are not necessarily the opinion of this station or its management or Independent Financial Group, LLC, its affiliates, officers, or directors. Material on this program is intended for general information only and should not be taken as specific investment, tax, or legal advice. We are here to talk about your finances, investments, and the economy, and we are aiming to change the way America thinks about investing. All right, so now we're going to go to our interview with Matthew Ike, the Executive Vice President of U.S. Energy, one of our friends in the West Texas oil patch.
I think everyone has heard an awful lot of noise in the marketplace about oil this year and the last several months. And I think people are somewhat confused. I think there's news about what's happening from a geopolitical perspective. There's news what's happening from a political perspective here in the United States. Supply and demand, general economic concerns as to where does oil fit in the big picture with renewables. There's just a lot of noise. And so sometimes having a lot of that noise, weeding through all of that can be difficult for a lot of people. And that's hopefully our job to help. So here's what we know. And I can sum it up by saying we don't know anything, right? So here's what you hear out there. There's going to be significantly less regulation, which would theoretically mean more supply, which would mean lower oil prices or natural gas prices for that second. You also hear that there's going to be significant sanctions on Iran, which would technically mean less supply, which would mean high oil prices. You hear about tax reform and how that affects the industry, potentially the Chinese trade deficit and what happens if tariffs come into place. Where is China in terms of the global growth? Are we up or down in supply? Are we up and down in demand? And where are prices? And basically what I've heard from most people is they're very confused. And what they're very confused about is what's the perception, what's the reality, and specifically under the Trump administration over the next 4 years, what really is likely to happen? And again, you can't have a crystal ball and know exactly what's going to happen. But the beauty is we have a prior 4 years that we can rely upon, that we've seen. We have a pretty good roadmap for what's likely to happen, and we can have the discussion. So I thought I'd start with this. Presidents historically do not have a significant impact on the average price of oil. Now, let me say average, meaning if you look back last 20 years, the average price of oil is $72 a barrel. Under Democrats, it's slightly higher, and under Republicans, it's slightly lower, but within a dollar or two. It is a very interesting dynamic when you look at where prices have been, regardless of who is the president. Why? Because the president doesn't really change global supply and demand balances from those. There can be geopolitical influence that has a lot of price swings, right? There can be major economic catastrophes like in 2008, right? There can be a COVID scenario. But in general, what you see over the last couple decades is a ever increasing, slightly increasing price of the underlying commodities, which is kind of sensical when you really think about the global consumption rates, right? And what's been happening in terms of we're constantly consuming more energy. So you're getting a slight uptick over time in the price of oil. Now, it doesn't mean will that happen going forward. We'll discuss that here in a second. But the administration actually doesn't have as big of an impact as people believe on the long-term average. It doesn't mean short-term things can't change, but long-term average, they tend to have less of an influence. So what really has the biggest influence here in this country is Wall Street. And really, it's had a major impact on the globe as well. Because right around 2016, the narrative and the paradigm has shifted dynamically. And for those of you who heard me say it before, I will emphasize this. Shareholders have different demands for energy companies than they have traditionally had. So you're actually seeing a lot of companies go more private because they're not being valued as favorably in the public marketplaces. But the public market has, in essence, had energy companies stopped that growth at any price and focused on shareholder value, buying back shares, paying dividends, operating within cash flow, and limiting their carbon exposure. Because of this, Wall Street's impacts are going to be the primary driver of what happens on a go-forward basis, which is going to be very similar to what's been happening since 2016. We're going to see a lot of capital discipline. You're going to see modest increases in production, and you're going to see constantly higher prices. Because the one thing that always happens is if you get too low of pricing, people will produce less. They'll have less cash flow to reinvest because they still have to pay dividends and buy back shares. And they will, in essence, prices will rise on the backside. Right? The only time you tend to see, but you didn't see, is when oil hits 100, do U.S. producers produce more? And the last time, the answer was no. U.S. producers don't go out and produce more just because prices go higher. So you see a lot of discipline, and this ultimately is going to affect that 13 plus million barrels a day that's coming out of the U.S., right? The ultimate thing that's going to affect the U.S. is how much great inventory do we have left in the Permian Basin? At what point do the majors run out of the core of the core, which works at lower pricing? Now, you're always going to have more oil. There's always more to extract. It's at what cost, right? Oil can be extracted at $80, $90, $100, $120, $150 a barrel. It just can't be extracted at $30, $40, $50, $60, and $70. So ultimately, what will happen is you will get enough oil to meet the global demands over the next 10, 15, and 20 years, but it'll just have to be at a higher price set than what you see today. So ultimately, kind of an interesting dynamic, I think, that most people don't really pay attention to. Now, there's other factors outside of Wall Street, right? There can be banking relations, right? So the ability for oil and gas companies to get banking, this is where something like Trump could have an effect 3 to 4 years down the road. By changing some of the OCC's very heavy hand and regulation on banks not loaning to oil and gas companies, and technically if that opened up in several years, you could have smaller companies start coming back into the space and producing more oil and natural gas in the market. Now, the majors aren't really affected because they're not issuing for the banks. They're issuing debt into the marketplace. It's really about all the small companies that have become bankrupt or uncompetitive, right? 280 oil companies went out of business in 2016 to 2018, and they haven't come back. And they may never come back, or they might if banking relationships do change and more capital flows into the space. On top of that, what could start to happen is institutional money that has been completely avoiding oil and gas for the last 4 years may start to creep back in. If institutional capital comes back in, you could see some pricing increases where the cost of doing business gets higher because it's more competitive. More people bidding on the same amount of assets tends to rise prices. So things you can be wary of, again, that would take multiple years and major shifts. You'd have to see Yale and Harvard and these endowments drop. And I don't mean this in a political way, but the woke concept of no oil and gas in their portfolios and start increasing their exposure back to the historical 10 to 14%, where they've gone from 14 down to 3 and are going to 0, they might reverse that trend. So in several years, that'll be an interesting dynamic. Do the institutional capital come back? If so, it wouldn't necessarily affect price. It might affect margins of how oil and gas companies compete. If they're competing with other private equity shops, if they're competing with other oil and gas companies, it could technically mean lower margins. And that'll be an interesting dynamic 4 years down the road to see what happens. I don't think they're coming back, but it'll be a very interesting discussion. So right now, where are we? Well, we're at that, 12.5-13 million barrels a day of production here in the U.S., depending on how you want to measure it, and 100 billion cubic feet of natural gas. Oil's back to where it was, right, pre-COVID. Basically, that's where we are. We think that's about where the U.S. is capped at its production. Right, without massive, and I mean massive, doubling the amount of capital that's going into space, I don't think you're going to see any higher than we're getting in U.S. production. Trump can't just say, go drill, because people have to have the capital to drill, and they have to have the desire to drill. And unfortunately, there's not necessarily, gas will be a different discussion. Natural gas is going to have a very different dynamic, I believe, going forward. And we'll kind of discuss on the gas side. But I think oil is exactly as it's been. If you're like us and you've been really profitable for the last 5 years, you're probably going to be extremely profitable, maybe slightly more profitable for the next five.
Well, Matt, a common question that we hear is why did institutional money leave in the recent 5 years or so?
Well, by charter mostly. So you had a massive influx of shareholder change of value. So ultimately, people believed one of the biggest evils was oil and gas. Now, I think that paradigm is shifting, but the charters, if you look at Yale, if you look at Harvard, you look at all these major institutions in the U.S., you look at all these pensions, New York Teachers Pension, you name it. In fact, New York Teachers Pension got sued recently because it has underperformed specifically because it avoided oil and gas. It was a very specific intent to drive the industry of capital. If you want to go really deep into this discussion, there is a philosophical difference between two political parties. And what side I'm on is not relevant for the discussion. One party believes that the U.S. will be more competitive if it's independent, if it has the cheapest cost of energy, and it can compete globally because we are, in essence, outside the box of everybody else with our energy independence. The other believes that the future is in renewables, and you have to, and people are always going to focus on the lowest economic cost, right? At the end of the day, we are a country of capitalists, whether you believe or don't believe, and ultimately people will flow towards the lowest cost. So the other belief on the other side is that if you create enough dearth of capital going into a space, you will get dilapidated infrastructure. You will get costs that are too difficult. If you find the industry enough, if you make it too difficult to operate in, then other energy sources can become more economically competitive. Because on a pure economic basis, without all the credits and without dilapidated infrastructure and oil and gas, renewables won't work on a heads-up economic basis. So if you believe that you want renewables as the primary source of energy production, you have to wipe out the oil and gas industry. And that permeated all the way to capital flows and what institutions were investing in, into OCC regulations, into government regulations, you name it. The idea was to push one industry away and embrace another. And again, you don't have to like it or dislike it. It's just the fact of two different beliefs. And both believe that our country gets ahead under those two scenarios. Whatever way you want to go, it's, I think both parties have, in essence, positive intentions for the country, but that fight was silly. The reality was, in this energy addition that we're seeing, not transition, but addition, you need all energy sources. You need a massive amount of fossil fuels, but you also need to handle the growth of consumption through renewables. So you actually need to do both, not either or. And I think that we've been very wrong in thinking that these are somehow competitive against each other. The reality is the U.S. is stronger if we have more reliable, more energy that in essence keeps all prices in check and helps us all as consumers. So here are some of the positive things that I think are really going to happen. So people thought it was a negative. Hey, if federal leasing increases dramatically under Republican presidents, shouldn't that mean more supply? And the answer is not really, because the leasing doesn't necessarily handle supply. What it does is it creates a lot of efficiency. So imagine, as an operator, I'm operating in New Mexico and I have a lease that's 7,500 acres, but the most efficient wells that we drill are 14,000 or 21,000 feet in length. They're 3 miles long, not 1 mile wide. Because every mile you drill longer, the cost per foot is substantively less. So my economics on a 3 mile well are substantively better than my economics on a 1 mile well. By opening up leases in these areas where you're spotted both federal and private lands, you in essence can create more efficiencies. So that driller can now focus over the next 4 years of not doing 7,500 foot laterals, but 3 mile laterals. They'll drill less wells, but they'll get more dollar productivity per well. So that type of thing can really make a massive impact on the bottom line of energy companies, even though it doesn't necessarily increase the gross amount of production that's going to marketplace. And that's, again, good for all of us, right? So you're not necessarily going to increase supply because you open up those public lands, but you are going to change the nature of cost, right? Instead of focusing on a second tier, if it's primary acreage, you now have more tier one acreage to drill. And you don't have to focus on drilling even more wells in tier two acreage, would have less production per square foot. So I think ultimately what it is, it's an efficiency operations. And it goes way beyond this. This starts to go into the infrastructure side of the equation. A lot of oil and gas companies, especially the small companies, can't compete, right? When we do our economics, our partnership with a lot of publicly traded majors is because their net economics are better than what we can do in a lot of areas, in most areas in the U.S. And part of that is because the operational efficiencies they have. If you open up to allow for more infrastructure, more pipeline in place, more compression, all of the advances that we have available that have been closed the last 4 years, skip four, and then eight before that, when you increase the infrastructure side of the equation, the cost of doing business goes way down, right? So right now, someone in the Permian Basin might be selling natural gas, not for the $3 in MCF it trades in the market, but for 50 cents an MCF because they can't get their gas to market. They don't have the compression. They don't have the pipeline takeaway capacity. In 2 or 3 years, when the process gets much easier, right? Immediately it'll get easier, but it'll take a couple of years to actually get the infrastructure in place. You'll start to see companies that are now making all $3 an MCF off the same well. So their economics will boom because of the ability to now put in more infrastructure in the country, which really will make a substantial difference to us, whether it's oil, whether it's gas, liquids, you name it. It's kind of a win-win on all effects, right? So I use this as a great example because I want people to understand this. The Keystone Pipeline was 5% away from being complete, and it was a big political item to stop the Keystone Pipeline. The Keystone Pipeline takes oil from our best partner up in Canada, brings down that heavy crude that we can refine with light sweet crude here in the U.S. because we only produce light sweet. So when you combine the two, you get your distillates. So when that pipeline gets complete now, and it will get complete very fast, what it's going to do is lower the cost of diesel. It's going to have a substantial impact on the cost of diesel. And what that means for us is the price per barrel doesn't change. You still sell it at $72 a barrel. But now when consumers are seeing less price at the pump, especially with long-haul transport, that really starts to lower the inflation, right? So there's some really big effects that can happen that people don't see right away that'll be real benefits in this administration. What it will hurt, and it's kind of sad, it'll hurt renewables. Because just from a heads up, we've looked at over 1,000 renewable deals. And even with all the government $5 trillion of incentives, they don't work economically on a project-by-project basis. They can work in scale when you're getting all the government handouts and you're getting paid for the electricity and you name it, but they really don't work on a straight economic basis. So for a couple of years, I think it's going to cripple the investment on the renewable side that will eventually pick back up once there's kind of a parity and a wipeout, kind of like there was in 16, there may be a wipeout in renewables for a couple of years. The industry will come back with vengeance, but it will take several years of readjustment where it's not subsidized by the government to get there. So real quick, I think this is super important for everyone to understand. And this is, I'm actually torn as to what Trump is going to do with LNG exports. So what you'll see are, there's a bunch of the red dots here waiting for approval. And these terminals that will export LNG, liquefied natural gas, globally, is a really interesting dynamic. Because if you really go to the core of the Republican thesis and Trump's thesis, it's in essence that the U.S. becomes competitively better off against the whole world if we have cheaper energy, right? So in Europe, you're paying $13 to $18 an MCF for gas. In the U.S., you're paying $3. If the U.S. starts exporting more and more and more, at what time will it start to become more competitive on the global pricing? Which means U.S. consumers would have to pay more, right? So if we got to a point where it was pari passu with the rest of the world, that would not be good for the U.S. So I think it's a kind of an interesting dynamic to really look at. So I'm not sure where Trump's going to stand on allowing for large-scale LNG exports. I think it's great from a capitalist standpoint. I think China would love for us to do it because it helped them balance their trade balance a little more. They would buy things like LNG for us, which would potentially lower some of the tariff penalties that they might see. So it'll be a really interesting, even if they don't, the yellow lines here and the orange lines are what's coming to market anyways. And we're going to get to 28 BCF of our gas, 28% in essence of our gas will be exported across the globe. And that's going to bring higher natural gas prices alone. So you're already starting to see this. It's already starting to happen. It'll be something to study over the next couple of years as to Trump want to be free market or manipulate the market. And I'm not sure which way it'll go. I can't tell you I know which way that's going to go. But it could move gas prices from the difference of $4 an MCF to $9 an MCF. So I have to believe they're going to limit it somewhat if they see prices rise too much. The beauty here in the U.S., truthfully, is if prices start to go too high, we do have an infinite supply of natural gas. So if we put the right infrastructure in place now, even if we export 30 BCF, 40 BCF, 50 BCF, we could, in essence, provide that much in this country. We are Saudi Arabia times 20 of natural gas. There is so much in this country that we could keep prices down if energy companies work with the government as they allow more exports to increase production. And I think that's where a pairing could really become powerful to put the U.S. in a driver's seat globally, where companies still make great money and the rest of the world is paying 14 and we're still paying 4, and that's profitable for everybody. And making some money on a much bigger volume is even more beneficial than making a lot of money on a little volume. So that might be 2 cents on the natural gas side of the equation of what's coming. We do export natural gas now, and we do export already. You can't become independent from oil, even if you produce. We already produce enough to match our consumption. So you can say we're independent. The reality is you have to import from at least Canada and Mexico and other areas the heavy crude to mix with the light sweet crude to create distillates. So ultimately, we're all interdependent on each other, right? But from a natural gas perspective, we are fully independent. So when you talk about the electrification of America and going to a lot of the electric grid, not just EVs, but a lot of things, ultimately, we are independent and we can be 100% independent infinitum on that side of the equation. I don't know enough of who's going to run this part of the administration. So it'll be an interesting dynamic. I want to get personally involved to find out. But I believe if energy companies work lockstep with the government, we can export infinitely larger quantities without having prices dramatically go up on the natural gas side. Now, AI is going to throw everyone through a loop when you see the consumption of energy from AI. Again, the good thing is the US can handle it if we build the right infrastructure and if we drill enough on the natural gas side. And I think that's where drill baby drill is going to happen, is on the natural gas side, that once consumption, people see the numbers, this 20 to 30% daily consumption increase coming from AI, there's only one source of energy to match it, and that's natural gas. And so you're already starting to see several public companies build relationships with Microsofts and Teslas and you name it, to build these chip factories that are consuming 20% of the annual supply overnight, meaning the city of Dallas will consume less than the chip factory that's going to be out there for an AI center. That's how big these are. And ultimately, you're going to have someone pair to match that.
Well, Matt, with all the AI demand of electricity that you're referring to, can nuclear energy be part of that solution?
So it's a whole massive conversation, and I'm not the world's expert in nuclear, but modular nuclear especially, I think, is going to become popular. We do have a NIMBY problem still, and not in my backyard in this country. I think we made one of the biggest mistakes in the world in the 70s of going away from it, because now we're way behind. You know, you're 15 years before making a significant impact. But I think when you look generations out, the rest of the world is going to have to go to nuclear or buy our gas. The U.S. may not be as focused on it, just because we have such an abundance of natural gas. It's so BTU rich. You can create so much energy from a BTU of gas, from natural gas, that it may not be as popular here as in the rest of the world, but you will still see it, right? So as long as regulation works favorably, and I think this administration will, you'll start to see nuclear, modular nuclear come here to the U.S., but probably not in enough of a capacity to make a material impact. But if you were to ask scientifically, it's by far the most energy dense, and it is the best long-term solution for the world. It has some side effects. We all have concerns. But at the end of the day, we should all have been going for the last 30 years towards nuclear, and we didn't.
We have a lot of questions people ask about the oil in the Permian. How much oil do you believe is left in the Permian?
So this is a great question. So tier one acreage will become tier 1A, which will become tier two. So meaning your dollar spent for every well, you'll get less output over the next 10 years than you're getting now. It probably won't change for 3 to 5 years, but you'll start to see a slight... Now, the technology keeps increasing exponentially as well. So, and the dollars per foot of cost is going down. So you're actually creating net economics that are very similar, if not identical to the past. But on a pure basis of where the reserve is and where you're going, if you're not in the best of the best, that's why we focus so heavily on investing with majors and drilling in just the core of the Permian, because there's really nothing that competes with it on the globe. You will not run out of the Permian. It'll become a mature field at some point in time. And like all fields, you can get more oil from that stone. You're only getting 12% of the oil from the stone. Ultimately, you can get more. It's just at a higher cost. So what it is cheap oil will go away in 15 years. It'll be a lot more expensive. And it'll start edging out every 3-5 years. That'll get more expensive. But if the costs of drilling come down and the technology keeps advancing, you'll stay flat regardless. But there's one thing I don't like, and that's this geopolitical tension. We have been very fortunate that China has been way under their growth expectations post-COVID. And because of that, the world is still consuming only 1% to 2% more oil than it was a couple years ago. Right, 102 million barrels a day, not 105. The reason that's scary, because outside of Saudi Arabia, there's not much excess production. And ultimately, if consumption continues to go up, you start to have a battle globally for oil. And the only way to consume less is to price people out. And that gets really scary because that's about $150 a barrel, start pricing people out. And once that starts happening, it really affects the global economy. And worse yet, it affects our economy here in the US because it's a regressive tax, right? It hurts the lowest end of our economy a lot more than the high end. So ultimately, we don't want to see super high oil prices. And we could have been there already if China had come out of COVID much stronger than they did. But what scares me right now is really what's happening in Iran and in Israel and in the Middle East. Because when you look at the numbers, there's 30 million barrels a day, 30% of the global production coming through this small area. If something actually escalates and the oil fields get attacked, there is no topside of price. $200 a barrel is just a number. It could be 400. That's horrible for all of us globally. That means recession, right? Sure, it means a ton of profit for those who have invested, but that abates. And so ultimately, what I want to see is a much more stable Middle East where the fear of production going offline is not there. Because this, we have been so fortunate that we haven't had geopolitical tensions go into pricing. Because in most market conditions, you couldn't even price in what would happen there. It's just too massive, right? Iran alone, the 4.6 million barrels a day. Now, what I think is going to happen here on the Trump administration is I think while they will sanction Iran, the oil doesn't usually go off the market. What happens is they sell it in the black market to China, but still being consumed, just not on the books. And they sell it for a lot less, obviously. So China wins, everybody else loses, right? And you'll have potentially India also buy it off the books as well. But what you'll have is a shifting. But as that happens, I think the difference is this administration will work very hard to have Saudi Arabia work with the U.S. and bridge that gap where they start producing more. If any actual supply comes off market from Iran, I think that you would have a partner who would increase production so that you don't get a price shock to the high. Again, I think everyone thinks I want to have high oil prices. We are so profitable where we are. The last thing I want is any kind of geopolitical issue that affects the economy here in the U.S. So I hope that this abates, and I think it will abate under this administration. For good or bad, that is one positive outcome I think will happen. Getting rid of that geopolitical tension that could have a global effect that people just haven't been pricing. Here's the scary part, guys, that I always talk about. Regardless of all the short-term noise, the world keeps growing, right? It keeps growing in population base. And the world wants to live like us. And we are growing at 2% a year plus consumption of energy. And when you get down to the statistics, 2% scary enough. If it goes more, it's even scarier. After $7 trillion now spending on renewables, it's eating less of half of the growth of consumption. Let me repeat that. It's not eating into the base load at all. It's providing less than half of the 2% we need to grow. It's only 0.6% renewables and 1.4% fossil fuels that are meeting the growing demand. So we have to get better and figure out how to get more product to market. Because in 5 years, if the world is consuming 106 barrels of oil a day, nobody really knows where that comes from. It's not coming from the US unless oil is 150 plus. And it's not coming from Saudi Arabia. So ultimately, we need to get to a point of figuring out how to get renewables to meet that 2% growth. So again, I think people always think that if you're one, you're against the other. No. For human population to continue to grow, every major innovation we make consumes more energy, right? You're now looking at AI, it's insane the amount of energy it's going to consume. Globally, it's going to change the whole paradigm of energy consumption. You need more energy, not less energy. It's an all the above strategy. And you're never replacing the base load. If you even look at the UN, you know, carbon plans to try to get to carbon zero, you're still going to be consuming more fossil fuels in the next 40 years than you do now. And that's if we were to ever meet the Paris Accords, which is we're so far off from. Right. The whole hope is that we can reduce coal or at least get the carbon out of the atmosphere, sequester carbon, right, through carbon sequestration and move away from the carbon side of it. But you're still going to consume infinite amounts of it.
All right. Well, this so far is a lot of good information. But another question we have. So do you see the deregulation story affecting deep water drilling?
Yeah. And that's, you know, that's one of those hopes because that's a 5+ year project for doing deep water drilling. And I think the world will need the U.S. to be producing 14 to 15 million barrels a day by, you know, 2030. And so I think it's really important that this administration does get some deep water drilling moving, because there's, you can't produce enough in the lower 48 to meet growing demand. So it is hopeful. Again, whether you like it or don't like it, one of the things that we really have to do is make sure that we protect Alaska. And I say protect Alaska, you need to protect it against Russia and the world's worst actors. So they're going to come in and drill underneath if we don't drill. So you want the best environmental stewards building that future infrastructure there and not letting the world's worst actors do it. So those maritime rights, as you've watched China take over different islands and create islands for maritime, you're going to see Russia do the same thing. Ultimately, the U.S. has to be the first there, and it has to protect and preserve nature. And it's the only country that has standards when it comes to this.
All right, Matthew, another question we get from clients is wanting to know about supply and demand with oil and how that affects the profitability of companies working in the oil area. At what price point per barrel do the oil companies make money?
So that's going to change every year, right? Based on the cost of extraction, cost of doing business. It's changed way up during COVID, or right after COVID, during inflationary times, and then way back down. So your average U.S. oil company, which is now all consolidated to the majors and a couple companies like us, there's no more small operators. If you're a small operator, it's probably almost 60 to 70% higher than it is the majors, which is crazy to think about. But it's become uncompetitive for small operators to really be in the energy patch. But in the oil world, you're probably talking in the high 48, low $50 barrel for a real profitability that gives you high internal rates of return. If you start to get below that price, you don't want to spend new money on wells. You can operate existing wells in the Permian at $24, $25 a barrel and still generate revenue, but probably not enough to generate a revenue to get you your original investment or any return of investment beyond that. So it's still way far away and very profitable to be in the oil patch. That will shift over time, right? If technology doesn't improve and 5 years from now, you have to move out to a further part of the pasture where there's less science improving. Let's say the geology is a little bit lesser, more gas, less oil. It might go up to $58 a barrel in a couple of years or 60. If the technology keeps doing what it's doing, where it improves, as you'll probably stay pretty flat. It stayed flat for the last 5-6 years outside of a massive spike up in 2021 because of inflationary pressures. It's been pretty consistent. You know, some of the real, I think, outside of the infrastructure, you're going to see some tax law changes that come into. And we use this as an example, but it's not the end all be all. So you're going to start probably see a rule provision of the Opportunity Zone tax law. This is something that's really helped us as a company because the majority of the Permian Basin is an op zone. And so something like that extension now will incentivize companies to take advantage of it. And I think people will realize how powerful this law is in not just real estate, but in oil and gas, in a lot of other business sectors. And I think that like the op zone, I don't want to be all inclusive and focus on just that. You're going to have some huge potential arbitrages that will exist under this administration. And the second time around, I think people will be more aware of them. And be able, so as far as I know, we're the only energy company in the U.S. that's using this tax law in mass and in favor, and it's creating massive wealth arbitrage. And I'm a little surprised the rest of the world doesn't, but I think they'll figure it out. It's one of my personal conversations is to spend time with the administration talking about it and how to promote it, even if it creates some competition for me, it's good for everybody. And one of the real big advantages in a lot of the blue states, especially if you look here through the Utica and the Marcellus Shale, the blue states really only had urban centers, and you can't drill natural gas wells in urban centers. So in this gas-rich region right here, not only are we able to put new infrastructure in, but if we can expand the opportunity zones to more rural areas, which is one of the main clauses that's likely to go into this new update, I think what you'll have is a lot of investment that'll create the exact condition I'm talking about and be a boon for natural gas, right? For drilling. Now, that'll keep prices in check, which is what Trump wants. You won't get $6 MCF gas if you have great infrastructure and takeaway capacity. But the U.S. will be in a globally dominant position when we already have defined property rights, so people don't take your AI, right? And you already have cheap energy, all right? It puts us in low tax base. It puts us globally in the best position for the next 5 to 7 years to beat out the rest of the world. And I think that is really where we're going to be. And if that becomes the case, which I think is the reality, then even the stock market at 22 times earnings isn't overpriced if what is likely to happen happens. So it'll be a really interesting study over the next 3 to 5 years to see how this rolls.
That will be very interesting to see. And so another question we have for you. If a client or a person that's interested and investing in oil has hesitations because of climate change. What would you say to a client who objects because of climate change?
I would tell you, I think it is if you really believe in climate change, it is the most imperative thing to invest in domestic energy, because there is no other source to meet the global demand, right? Energy, the whole reason that we live the way we live across the world and all the constant human condition that's improving is because of abundant energy. And we're going to be using infinite amounts of it. You want to invest in the countries and the people who care the most about the environment, right? The U.S. is determined to create the cleanest, most efficient, and energy abundant. You will have carbon capture technology that will remove carbon from the atmosphere. So if you believe that's the issue, the technology on the other side is coming to remove it from atmosphere. You already have heavy regulations on methane emissions of not being released, and it'll get better and better and better. And so by not investing in the U.S., all you're doing is giving money to the rest of the world, where the world's worst actors, Venezuela, Russia, Iraq, Iran, you have all these countries that in essence are the world's worst actors who will be producing the most of it and getting the profits and continue to be empowered to be bad. The best thing, if you really believe in it, is to only invest in domestic energy, because most energy companies believe in being green and being clean. Like, I'm literally ISO 14,000 certified. I have no carbon emissions, zero, and I'm an oil company because we care. We don't talk about it. We don't promote it. We're not there to be green. But the most of the oil and gas industry is the most stewards of our environment that you could ever imagine.
Well, it's a very good point that, you know, America is probably one of the greenest countries when it comes to making their energy. So it is something to very much to consider when it comes to climate change. Another common question, especially after the past couple of years where we've had a lot of inflation, how do oil prices and inflation go together?
It's not directly related. Normally hard assets tend to perform well during inflationary times. But I mean, inflation is really just a cause of government printing too much money, right? So the two aren't necessarily. Now, what you really think about is the cost of energy being too much, in essence, is a tax. It causes the cost of transportation of all of our goods and services to be more expensive. So in essence, you think of it as inflationary, right? Too high of energy prices. But I want to put it in this context. The average spend of an American right now on energy is less than 3.5% of their budget. Historically, it's about 16%. We've become so much more efficient and we make so much more. It's actually a deflationary item in the overall scheme of things. So oil would have to be about $170 a barrel for it to inflation adjusted be where it was historically. People don't really think about it that way. They think 100 is some magic. But the efficiency that we constantly have and what we're doing as a country and constantly creating more efficiency, no matter how many more humans we continue to have, 360 million Americans, we go up, our energy consumption per person gets more efficient every year. We're pretty powerful and we're really good as a nation and as of growing that efficiently.
All right, Matthew, do you think that oil will or can go off the dollar? And what would it mean if it did?
So it would be good for an oil company, right? Because the dollar is by far the world's, cleanest shirt in the dirty laundry. So the dollar continues to strengthen, which is why you see lower prices of oil in U.S. dollars. But it is possible China's talked about trying to get away from the U.S. currency for multiple reasons. I don't think China's in the position to do that for the next 5 to 7 years. Oil is an interesting, if you think about it, if you're Saudi Arabia and you're the Middle East and you're OPEC, you're not selling your oil to the U.S. You're selling it to other places. So being in the U.S. dollar does lose a lot of control. I think under the Trump administration, that conversation is gone. I think under the last administration, it was a probability it could have happened. So that means there is a probability it can happen again. I just don't think you really have to have that discussion for the next 4 to 6 years. But it's real. Now, what does it do? It makes U.S. oil prices higher. Right now, we are the benefactor of a strong dollar, which is energy is cheaper for us than everybody else. Again, I think it's one of our global superpowers is that we have cheaper energy than the rest of the world. So I guess as an investor, you hope it goes off the dollar and you make more money.
All right. And for our last question for this interview, Matthew, how has the Green New Deal agenda impacted pension fund divestments and legal actions against firms?
I'm not sure I'm the best expert. I know anecdotal cases where, those who followed it are going to face some lawsuits if they underperformed. I think the market's done well enough to hide and mask a lot of that underperformance. So unless energy goes up too much and there's a disproportionate return, which I don't really see happening, right? Especially when you look at NVIDIA and its control of the market and the next boom of AI. I think tech has been too big a part of the overall performance of the market. So it's muted the fact that people who've avoided energy have underperformed. So I think you'll see less lawsuits. I don't think there's that much. I think you'll see a major change going forward where people will be more reluctant. But a lot of the charters have permanently banned carbon. And again, I think this reminds me of the 1970s stupidity about nuclear. We just don't know. We're voting with our heart, not with our head. We're not really realizing that by investing in domestic energy and taking an active role, you're doing more than by trying to avoid the asset class, because it's a necessity and it's something that the world needs, right? Even if you got rid of fuel as transport, 80% of fuel is used in everything that you use, from your plastics and your, what you're taking in your pills, to your chairs and your car, to, I mean, there's more oil consumed in an EV vehicle than there is in a traditional ICE vehicle. People don't really realize the concept of what it's utilized for. And it's not just for transportation. All you would do is strand transportation fuel, which means it would go to other parts of the world at a lower cost. You'd still have the 80% of oil being consumed for plastics and everything else that's used for. So I don't think people get the whole world and its understanding. It's just people vote with their hearts and they don't really get deep enough into it to understand what they're doing. It's all well-intended. It's just not real.
All right. Well, I hope you enjoyed our interview with Matthew Ike of U.S. Energy.
We really appreciate his time. And again, if you would like to learn more about us, you can go to our website, cornerstonereport.com. That's cornerstonereport.com for newsletters, previous radio shows. And if you'd like a free consultation, please reach out at 800-327-4285. 800-327-4285. Jerry Tuma Smart Money is a broadcast of Cornerstone Financial Services of Dallas, Texas. Jerry Tuma is a certified financial planner. Financial advisors at Cornerstone could help you if you prefer to delegate your investment decisions to a financial professional. Securities and advisory services offered through Independent Financial Group, LLC, a registered investment advisor, member FINRA, SIPC. Cornerstone Financial Services and Independent Financial Group, LLC, are unaffiliated entities. We publish a newsletter, Cornerstone Report, which is available on our website or by calling our toll-free number at 800-327-4285. That's also the number to call for more information about anything we've discussed during today's broadcast. For more information, visit our website at cornerstonereport.com. Views and opinions heard on Jerry Tuma's Smart Money are not necessarily the opinion of this station or its management or Independent Financial Group, LLC, its affiliates, officers, or directors. Material on this program is intended for general information only and should not be taken as specific investment, tax, or legal advice. Remember, we are aiming to change the way America thinks about investing.